You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, welcome to the Choose FI Radio Podcast. Today, we are going to be featuring a reveal. This is for the books, my friends. We have Big Earn, and my understanding is he is just about to put in his 2 weeks. Big Earn has been a fixture in this community, and last year, his website just blew up. In no small part due to the epic content that he's been putting together featuring the limitations of the 4% rule. And also, really, that's just almost a gateway to his content, the power of sequence of return risk, and then how to minimize that as you plan your drawdown strategy. What I'm hoping that we can do, and what Earn has been so proficient at, is poking holes both at the sacred cows of the personal finance community, but also turning it back on the FI community and challenging those sacred cows as well. And he just takes ideas that maybe people have long taken for granted, and then just goes back to the math. And today, we're hoping to get Big Earn to maybe talk to us a little bit about emergency funds and how they fit into his own FI plan. So this is going to be a fascinating conversation. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
I am doing well, Jonathan. Yeah, it's always a real treat when we have Earn on the podcast. And he's one of, really, in my mind, one of the most important members of the FI community. He's doing just brilliant stuff at his website. And I love how involved he's become in the Choose FI community, both here as an in-house expert on the podcast and in our Facebook group. And he thinks differently. Even amongst a group of contrarians, he's always looking to challenge that orthodoxy and not just take things at face value. And that's a really important mental skill that I greatly, greatly appreciate in Earn. And yeah, he's got some big news. So yeah, let's get to it. Earn, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back.
So Earn, I think we should start. As much as I would love to just call you Big Earn for the rest of time, what is your given name?
My real name is Karsten, K-A-R-S-T-E-N. I'm from Germany, and I've been in the U.S. for over 20 years now. I currently live in San Francisco with my wife. Her name is Crystal, and she's an immigrant too. She's from the Philippines originally.
So I was talking to Brad before we hopped on the show, and I said, you know, Brad, I've never met Big Earn in person, and how amazing would it be if he were like 5'6" tall? That would be just the perfect thing ever. But we got on the conversation and asked you, you're 6'6".
That's right.
You're the tallest member of the FI community.
Who knows? I mean, there might be some other anonymous blogger somewhere. They're even bigger. So I think that's why the Big Earn stuck with me. So
we'll look for you at FinCon, head and shoulders above everybody else.
Yes. And millionaire educator too. He's got to be up there. Let's see a back-to-back comparison at FinCon. He's a former D1 college basketball player. So how does this feel? I mean, you've been anonymous for the entire length of your blog, and now life is changing. Is this nerve-wracking to not be anonymous anymore?
Well, it was nerve-wracking while I was anonymous, and I was thinking, well, if some people find me out, which hasn't happened. So nobody at the office told me, hey, I found this blog, Early Retirement Now, that awfully sounds like you, or nobody listening to the podcast heard my voice and realized, hey, that must be Karsten. The reason why I prefer to stay anonymous until I actually give notice is that if you work in corporate America, you don't want to signal to your employer that you're on the way out. I mean, obviously, you want to put in your hard work and do it until the end. And you don't want people to suspect that you're not really pulling your weight at the office. So that's why I try to keep this under the wraps. Obviously, since I work in finance, so there's another dimension of that. In finance, you get your annual bonus early during the year, and you obviously don't want your employer to, say, cut your bonus because they think, hey, if this guy leaves anyways, we're not going to pay him his full bonus he deserves. So that was another great uncertainty and anxiety. What if they find out and they give me less of a bonus? And that whole last year was kind of for nothing.
Now, you've disclosed on your blog that this is an industry that you work in, the industry of finance. And so I'm curious how much of the content that you've put together was very closely tied to research that you were already doing in the context of your job.
There's a little bit of overlap, but I don't think it's that much overlap because, I mean, I'm doing something on safe withdrawal rates. The retail investor is not the typical person that we deal with at the office. So we have our typical client would be a pension fund or an endowment or a sovereign wealth fund. On a day-to-day basis, I have absolutely no contact with retail investors. But then again, kind of the general philosophy, I'm an index investor personally. Also at the office, I'm not a stock picker either. So people sometimes think that if you work in finance, oh, can you give me a stock tip, right? And that's not at all what I'm doing. So I'm thinking more about the bigger picture, about what are the trade-offs between stocks and bonds? What are the pros and cons of diversification? What are the pros and cons of different equity markets, right? Is the international side more attractive or is it okay to just stay in US stocks? So these are all questions that I think about in my job. And I've written about that on my blog too. Then obviously, professionally, I'm generally relatively bullish on stocks. That probably shows through in my blogging activity. So yeah, I mean, obviously there are some overlaps, but there's working in finance definitely helped me put together a lot of interesting finance content.
So it's funny. I want to call you Earn. I mean, I'm so used to the name Big Earn, which I love. It's like one of my absolute favorite names, but I'll try to call you Carsten from here on out. But I'm curious. So we're recording this in late February and it's going live on March 12th. And I assume based on what you said, you were waiting for this bonus. So the bonus came through sometime in early 2018 and you're good to go. Like, have you started even roughly telling anyone in your life about this early retirement, about the blog, maybe not at work, but just people that are close to you? Like, has anything changed this calendar year so far, or have you been really walling it off until you give your 2 weeks?
So we kept the decision to retire early a secret until recently, except for some very close relatives and one very close friend of mine. And the reason was that there's obviously some overlap between our friends here in San Francisco and my colleagues. And I don't want them to say if we run into each other or we have lunch together, somebody makes a wrong comment and says, hey, how is your early retirement planning going? So in that sense, we tried to keep that as tight to us as possible. But then obviously now we've started talking to our friends, and I haven't announced the decision at work yet because actually the bonus will be paid out on February 28th. But then again, I have the paperwork, everything is black and white. So I can probably start doing that now. And that's that's something that I will do between now when we're recording this and when the broadcast on March 12th.
So 44 years old, based on what you disclose on your blog, you are well past having to worry about whether or not it's the 4% rule or the 4% rule of thumb. But what does the actual transition like? What actually changes and what happens for you in a post-FI life? This is a massive decision.
I can tell you this is the third time I feel this kind of level of anxiety, because that is such a, in mathematics, you would call it a discontinuity, right? I mean, the path completely changes. The first time when I came from Germany to the US, right, that's a pretty life-changing event. The second time going from a relatively safe job and going to a finance job in 2008, right around the global financial crisis. So that was a lot of anxiety. And now the same thing, right? You go from having a paycheck and going to work every day, you go from that to having to withdraw money and living off your money and knowing all the things about sequence of returns risk. That's obviously cause for some anxiety. So that's I definitely have to concede that.
So based on your level of understanding of the mathematics, you know you're fine, but yet there's still this anxiety. And I find that so interesting because that's the real world scenario. And everyone needs to understand out there, no matter how buttoned up you have this, no matter how set you are, there's still the normal human emotions. And it's interesting to talk through this with you and to hear like what you're actually thinking. Like, what surprised you the most from this level of anxiety and this uncertainty? Has anything really stuck out to you as, oh, wow, I didn't expect I'd feel that way?
Yeah. So, I mean, the anxiety, I mean, for example, you're anxious about leaving your job. I was also anxious about getting cold feet in the end again, right? So, and in some way, the way to deal with that is to almost take actions to almost handcuff yourself to the decision to retire early. And so I found two ways of doing that. The first one is going on your podcast.
I knew it. I was going to say, this is your handcuff, isn't it?
So that means now the truth will be out on March 12th, and there's no way back. You would probably blackmail me for $1 million if I changed my mind. So that's one way. And then the other way is, and this actually came about almost by surprise. So we have an apartment. We own an apartment here in San Francisco. And we knew we will sell this and then move someplace else to a cheaper location and lower income tax location. So we knew we have to sell this place. And it turns out we got an offer so early. So we talked to a real estate agent late in December. So I wasn't really expecting anything to come out of that. But then in early January, the guy says, well, I have a buyer, a prospective buyer. The unit wasn't even on the market yet, right? We didn't move out yet. We didn't fix up the place. We didn't paint the walls. We didn't do anything. And the real estate agent said, well, I have somebody who is interested. And they looked through the unit with all of our stuff here, right? So obviously, it was nice and clean. And we spruced up everything a little bit. But there was nothing. We didn't paint anything. We didn't do any repairs. And we basically had an offer the next day. And the closing was 11 days later. So we already sold the unit. And we are now renting our own unit back from the new landlord temporarily. I mean, that's pretty much of a handcuff to early retirement as you can get, because it means we have to move out of here. That's another way of getting that commitment to actually retire early and not back out in the last minute.
And what's so funny is you actually have an awesome retirement cohort in that Fritz from Retirement Manifesto is retiring with you basically the exact same time.
Yeah. So we had, there's a bunch of us all around the same time going public, either retiring early or semi-retiring early. That's really exciting news. Now, there's one thing I should mention. So because I haven't given notice yet, there is that one additional last uncertainty that is still out there. So what if at work they tell me, okay, we promote you, we pay you 10 times your salary and we give you a nicer title. And there are still some uncertainty. I don't think that will happen, but there could be something in between, right? Where they say, okay, well, we hate to see you go, but can you stay on for maybe another year as a consultant or something like that, where you're free to travel and do what you want and you do your blogging on the side, but for maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 hours a week, we will acquire your services. And that would obviously something that I would do. But so the full-time work, going to the office 9 to 6 or 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 every day, that is definitely done, because we've already sold our unit. And it's not like we're going to buy back another place in San Francisco now. It's so outrageously expensive here.
You know what I think is so interesting about talking about the cohort of people that are retiring at this exact time is when you have been documenting your 23 plus part series on safe withdrawal rates, one of the things that's lurking in the background is that we have had an extraordinarily long bull market, and that the other side of that must mean that there's some form of a correction. And if it gets bad enough, now we're talking about the exact scenario that we've been discussing, you know, in that prior episode 35 with you, a wonderful episode talking about sequence of return risk. And so it strikes me looking back, and I had this light bulb moment just now, that everything that you've done up to this point is to prepare you for the worst possible case scenario, where in that first couple of years, you are that 1967 cohort, right?
Right. And that is obviously the risk when people in the FI community, they retire not, say, automatically when reaching age 65 or 67, which is what everybody else does. And then, you know, you basically randomly retire at some year, and it could be a good year to retire or a bad year to retire. But we basically do that Mr. Money Mustache simple math approach, right? We save and save and save. When we reach a certain target, then we retire. So the problem with that approach is that it raises the risk that you retire right at the peak of the market. So I'm definitely aware of that, and it's in the back of my mind. But then again, the way I've planned, I think we have enough safeties and enough layers of cushion that we can play with. I mean, obviously, we can always reduce our withdrawals. We can do some part-time work on the sides. Yeah, again, so the anxiety is, am I retiring right at the peak? Especially considering what happened in early February, right? So with the volatility in the market and what has happened since.
Ern, I'm curious. So you talked about those handcuffs, right? That you're setting up basically these fail safes so you can't back out. And you had sent us an email in late October with the subject proposal. And I opened this. I'm like, what on earth is going on here? And you basically said you wanted to reveal your identity in early March. So, I mean, you had been planning this for months in advance and setting up these fail safes so you couldn't back out. And I think that's a really cool mental framework for people to latch onto. I think if you would be susceptible to some of these psychological issues, everybody would be. So we all need to consider that. And I'm curious about your actual decision. So at some point before the end of October 2017, you and your wife sat down and said, okay, we're going to do this. Was it, as you just said a minute ago, was it just as simple as looking at the shockingly simple math, or, you know, looking at your math and saying, okay, we hit it, we're done? Or was there something else that factored into the actual decision?
So first of all, let me tell you, so you said something like, well, even I need these handcuffs. I mean, first of all, I think I'm one of the worst procrastinators and having trouble with sticking to the plan. So I think I'm the first to admit that it's actually good that I have these quote unquote handcuffs. I mean, in terms of the timing and when to retire, that is basically set by the bonus schedule in my firm, especially in finance, right? You get a pretty decent base salary that is pretty sufficient to live relatively comfortably, even in a place as expensive as San Francisco. But then the bonus, that's that one big extra payment that you get once a year. And my thinking was, so before the bonus is paid out, there's no point in leaving because I want to take that big payment. And then after that big bonus is paid, well, it's almost you want to retire then, because then it takes another year for the next bonus. I mean, I definitely like my job a lot, right? I have nice colleagues. The living here in San Francisco is very comfortable. I work for a company that's very well regarded. I have a nice window office on the 39th floor. I look out of the window, I see San Francisco. So it's a pretty good gig. But then again, you also realize that once you have achieved a certain level of wealth, basically the opportunity cost works the other way around, right? The first thing you learn in economics is opportunity cost. Well, you do fun stuff, and the opportunity cost as well, you can't earn money during that time. That's the typical opportunity cost example that they teach in economics. But then once you have enough money, it goes the other way around. Your opportunity cost is that you spend so much time at the office, you get only 20 or so vacation days a year, you don't get to see your loved ones as much as you like. And it starts at home, right? We have a 4-year-old daughter, and 5 days a week, I don't see much of her. And it also extends to all of our family, right? We just came back from Germany attending a funeral of someone we all cared very deeply about. You realize there's huge opportunity costs by not having the flexibility to travel when you want and seeing some people that are very close to you only once a year or maybe every 2 years. So that was definitely on our minds. I mean, even in 2017, we already had a pretty good cushion. And I thought that, okay, let's do another year. Let's do another year of salary and another bonus. And then we have that level of comfort that would entice me to give up this pretty comfortable life here in San Francisco.
You know, I thought it was interesting that you talked a little bit about what you would do in terms of being able to withdraw a little bit less and go back to work if you needed to, because in my mind, you're speaking directly to this idea of replacing fear with flexibility, which is an article that I'm grabbing the title from, one that Joel over at Fi 180 wrote. I mentioned that to say that, true to the content that you've been writing over the last year, you don't just start with an idea. You go dig into the math and you try to use your Excel sheets to demonstrate what it would actually look like. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what caused you to actually explore this idea of fear with flexibility, and also what the results were when you looked at how part-time income could offset sequence of return risk.
Right. I mean, this is essentially a direct follow-up from our discussion last year, right, in episode 35, because they said that in real life, nobody will really, I mean, even if you apply the 4% rule, nobody will ever really run out of money, right? Because you say you start with $1 million, you withdraw $40,000, and you see your portfolio go down and it dwindles. And by the time it hits $700,000, $600,000, $500,000, you will do something, right? And that's what everybody says. Well, you with your safe withdrawal rate research, this is all, it's all really nice math. But in the real world, nobody will run out of money because people will be flexible, right? All we need is flexibility. So you can always reduce your withdrawals for a while. You can go back to work, which, by the way, is something that going back to work is something that I probably would try to avoid, because it's not so easy to go back to work in the finance sector after you've been out for a while. But I give you that. Yeah, I mean, I could always do some consulting work on the side. I could be a Lyft driver for crying out loud. So this flexibility aspect, it definitely fascinates me, both the flexibility to work and to withdraw less. But I also noticed that people haven't really done a lot of quantitative research on that, right? So what does it mean, flexibility? I mean, I can be flexible, right? Does it mean that it's enough to just reduce my spending by 10%, 20%? How much do I have to reduce my spending to make the money last and not run out of money? And for how long do I have to do that, right? Do I have to do that for a year or two, or for as long as, say, the bear market lasts? What if the bear market wipes out your portfolio so badly, right? Because it's not just, it's the sequence of return risks. Your portfolio goes down, not just because equities are down, but also because you withdraw money. So your portfolio in retirement is going to take longer to recover than the stock market in general. So my interest was, for how long do I have to be flexible? So I did some simulations and I found that, well, there's some cohorts in history where, they basically had to go back to work for 25 years. And that is obviously, well, it's flexibility and you save the 4% rule. But I would still call that a failure. I mean, it's a failure of a different type. There's one failure of running out of money after 30 years or 40 years. And for me personally, it would be a failure if I'm 45 years old and I have to go back to work until I'm 70. I mean, that's not really early retirement. And even a part-time job, that would not be something that would appeal to me, certainly not for 25 years. For 2-3 years, I can always do that, but not for a decade or 2.5 decades.
So even though that doesn't particularly appeal to you, I like the idea that it is an option. And let's give a shout out to Jacob, who I guess was the reader that emailed you with his initial thoughts on what it should look like. And I loved his title. He called it the Get a Job Guardrail Plan. That is just made for blogging right there. What exactly was that proposal?
So the question is, how would you structure this in real life, right? Because you can always just wave your hands and say, well, I'll be flexible, right? And there's a million ways of being flexible, but it's a little bit too wishy-washy. And I'm a quantitative guy and I like to quantify even flexibility. So it sounds like an oxymoron, but the way to quantify is to have some kind of a rules-based approach where you say, you know, if you start with $1 million and your portfolio goes down to $950,000, you're not going to look for a part-time job yet, right? So you're going to at least wait for your portfolio to drop below a certain level, and then you would start to make adjustments. And his proposal was, and I looked at many different alternatives, and is actually what he proposed. I don't know if he did some calculations before on his own already, but his initial proposal was exactly what I ran with in that blog post, because it actually looked like it's something pretty reasonable. So basically what you do is you build a guardrail where if you say your portfolio drops to 70% below the target value, then you start getting a job and you supplement. I mean, either you get a job or you reduce your withdrawals, or you do a combination of it, and that's worth 30% of your annual budget. So say imagine you have a $40,000 annual withdrawal, you do a job that brings in $12,000. It's that should be pretty manageable for most people. So you need a guardrail for that, but you also need a guardrail for when do you stop working, right? When do you quit that part-time job again? And the guardrail I picked for that was, and this is, again, the same guardrail that he proposed, is that once you get back to 80% of your target portfolio value, then you quit that job again. And funny thing is, I played around with different parameters and I thought, maybe why don't you do your job until you reach your full target portfolio value again? Because it turns out in the simulations, I found that would actually be working way too long. Because remember, by the time you quit your job, your portfolio is recovering again and you're in the next bull market, you probably don't have to wait until you get all the way to 100% of your target portfolio value. You can already quit the job at 80%. So it's quite amazing. As I said, I was wondering, did he do the calculations already himself? Because it was spot on. And I played around with many different parameters and it worked really beautifully. But then again, I mean, what I found obviously is that potentially that will send you back to work for very long times.
I'm curious, as a listener, you mentioned the word cohorts before. Are you describing that as people who retire in a given calendar year? Is that how you split up your cohort? And also you said like the worst case was having to work for 25 years. But what does a normal case look like? It's great to talk about this flexibility, but if for an early retiree, the median case is 10 plus years, that's not an ideal scenario. So talk us through, what does this look like for the standard cohort and not these extreme outliers? And also just explain a little bit more about your methodology, if you don't mind.
Everything I do in my safe withdrawal rate series is based on simulating past returns. So when I say cohort, I would say, well, how would the September 1929 cohort have fared if they had started to withdraw 4% from their portfolio and they have, say, a 80-20 portfolio, 80% stocks, 20% bonds. The reason why I'm interested in some of these extreme cases like the 1929 cohort, and by the way, I do my simulations monthly, so I don't do, so they start in one calendar year, but every month in that calendar year would be one retirement cohort. So the reason why I'm looking at some of these extreme cases is that obviously these are the cases where the 4% rule failed, right? So if somebody tells me, all you have to do is be flexible and then you make the 4% rule work, then obviously the place where I would start looking is, well, when the 4% rule failed, how would you have fared with the flexibility? But it's good that you mentioned that, because obviously that's not the whole story, right? Because you also want to look at, well, were there cohorts where the 4% rule would have worked in hindsight? So you, after 50 years, you realize that, you know, a 4% rule would have succeeded and would have never worked. But you didn't know that in real time, right? After 12 years, if the market is down, you didn't know that in years 13, 14, 15, it will recover again. And in the end, everything will work out. You don't know that in real time. So what was very interesting and intriguing to me was that there were cases where using this guardrail rule of going back to work and or reducing withdrawals, using this rule, even people where the 4% rule would have worked would have gone back to work, and not just for a few months, but a few years. That's something that I found really intriguing, because it means that if you're trying to save the 4% rule, you also create some failures somewhere else. It's like pushing on a balloon, right? So you try to lower the failure rates in one place, but then you create failures of another sort somewhere else.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So when you're saying the failure of the 4% rule, that's where we're saying if you get to that first guardrail, right, the 70%, is that where this factors in? Like in a real world application, so someone retires and the safe withdrawal rate nightmare happens and their portfolio drops to 70% of its starting value. So is that and only that where people need to consider going back to work and where this flexibility needs to come in? Or would they start thinking about this more reasonably, like at a 80%, 90%, or are you saying the math says 70%, that's where you need to start thinking about it?
So again, I mean, I'm not very tight on where exactly you have to do that. I mean, if people wait until they drop to 68% of the target value, that's fine too. But the main point here is that you don't know in real time whether the 4% rule will eventually work out after 50 years. Of course, I mean, you will never go back to work if, say, you had retired in 1992 or something like that, which was a start of a big bull market and the portfolio is going up. So the portfolio never even drops below that 70% guardrail. But there should be many cases, and I documented a few, where the 4% rule eventually would have worked and where people went back to work, even though it wasn't necessary. So one case would have been I think it was a cohort in 1972. Again, you were exposed to the 1974 recession, 1980 and 81, 82 recession, and your portfolio was depleted by so much by 1982 that you probably would have been quite scared of running out of money. Well, what you didn't know is that the 1980s had one of the biggest bull markets in history, and it was interrupted a few times, per se, 1987 and 1991. But in some way, you could even argue that the bull market lasted from 1982 until 2001 with two minor interruptions. Since you didn't know that, you probably would have gone back to work in 1980, which, by the way, would also be a pretty bad time to go back to work because it was the bottom of the recession. So what I'm trying to say here is that trying to save the 4% rule with this flexibility mantra, I almost call it, right? Because people say, well, everything is saved by flexibility, but it also creates some problems. It saves some problems, it solves some problems, but it also creates some problems for some cohorts that would unnecessarily go back to work. I mean, for example, if you had retired at the peak of the stock market in 2007, yeah, I mean, your portfolio would have dropped by so much. You would have tried to find work again in 2009 or 10. Even though it wasn't even necessary. I mean, I'm pretty sure that history will show how this will work out in the end. But I'm pretty sure that, for example, the 2007 retirement cohort, they would have been fine with the 4% rule because the global financial crisis was very deep, but it wasn't that long. And there was a very strong bull market that followed it. And you would create this, what's called in statistics is a type 2 error. So kind of a false positive, a false alarm. And that false alarm is that you go back to work because you don't know yet at that time that a strong bull market is around the corner again.
It seems to me that with this concept of flexibility, your flexibility needs to have some diversity with it as well. The more options that you can lay out, maybe going back to work is the answer. Maybe having geo arbitrage as a possibility is an answer. Maybe having additional streams of income in the form of a rental property is an answer. I mean, I know as we start to talk about this with regards to your own personal plan, you have multiple options that you could put in place.
Right. So you want to have multiple layers of things that you can adjust. So both on the income side and on the spending side. And then it's one of the main reasons why I personally like to start with the lower safe withdrawal rate, right? So say something like 3.25% or 3.5%. So that gives you a bit of a cushion if the market doesn't cooperate and the market drops. Maybe at that time, you will be at 4% effective withdrawal rate, right? So that's probably one of the ways of saving your retirement is to maybe not retire just exactly when you hit 25 times. Everywhere else in life, we are a little bit more cautious about that, right? I mean, because I'm doing a lot of travel and airline reservations, I'm thinking in terms of a lot of airline analogies. So for example, you don't want the pilot that flies your plane to be just marginally and just barely capable of flying that plane, right? You want that pilot to be some kind of a crack pilot who is a retired fighter pilot that knows how to land fighter planes on moving aircraft carriers. And then when he flies that Boeing 777, then that's really easy for him. And he's, even if something bad happens, it's still inside his comfort zone. And I think the same way in terms of our retirement. So instead of pulling the plug exactly at 25 times annual spending, we accumulate a little bit longer. And so that gives us that comfort zone. Even if something bad happens, if one bad thing happens, or maybe even two or even three, we should still be safe. So that's where I'm coming from.
Okay, so Karsten, I have a transition all set up. I want to talk about opportunity cost. And the reason I want to talk about it is we were talking offline, comparing and contrasting your drawdown strategy with that of Fritz's from the Retirement Manifesto. And in particular, what makes this so interesting as a compare and contrast is that Fritz is a huge fan of having upwards of 2 years of cash set aside for his bucket strategy. And you are the exact opposite of that. In fact, in what I think is one of the most underrated pieces of literature on the blogosphere, one of your first articles was poking the hole at the idea of the emergency fund. And literally, to highlight this, in a universe where Dave Ramsey says you need to have a fully funded 3 to 6 month emergency fund, and Susie Orman says you need to have 8 months in cash saved up, and Fritz has 2 years of cash going into his drawdown strategy, your first article says our emergency fund is exactly $0.00. You have no emergency fund. In fact, you have written extensive articles explaining why. I would love to hear you justify that.
Well, this was one of the first blog posts I ever wrote. And, you know, funny thing is that is in some way, that was my first quote unquote claim to fame, right? So I didn't do the safe withdrawal rate series until, I believe, December 2016. And I wrote this post in May. But it did get a lot of attention at that time. So it was featured on A Physician on Fire, right? He has a Sunday's Best selection of his favorite reads from the week. And then it was also picked up by Rockstar Finance. So this was my first Rockstar Finance feature ever. So I laid out my thinking of the emergency fund. And so basically my thinking is I never had one. Obviously, our emergency fund is our big stash of our investment portfolio. And I don't see why, in addition to that, I have to have this big pile of cash sitting around on the side. Especially, so one of the things that makes life so much easier for us in the FI community, where we have, say, 50% savings rates, is that even if you have an emergency, say the car breaks down or some appliance in your house breaks down, if your savings rate is high enough, you should be able to fix that and pay for that just out of your future income, right? There's another paycheck coming in. Obviously, the one thing that I concede is that if you work in a job where you have to be worried that you lose your job and you will not find a new job for a while, then yeah, potentially you can have a little bit more of a cash cushion and an emergency fund. But again, I mean, my personal situation is that we had a very large net worth. And so even if I had lost my job, I mean, I would have just retired back then. I mean, that's especially with this whole anxiety about pulling the plug and retiring, it would have spared me that. If they had laid me off, I would have retired back then. So that's in a nutshell why we never had an emergency fund, really.
All right. So Carson, I'm curious, how does that work with someone like Fritz, who's obviously a really intelligent guy? He's a FI blogger. He's a member of our community, but he talks about almost the exact opposite, which is having these different buckets and moving entire years worth of expenses that he just has sitting in cash. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
I think we're going to have a cage match at the FinCon, and then Fritz and I are going to sort that out. No, I'm just kidding. First of all, let me say that when I wrote the article about the $0 emergency fund, I was still working, right? And when you still have income coming in, you get into this this dynamics where, you know, you don't want to have too much cash sitting around invested in equities and let the money grow, because even if the market drops in between, right, we get back into this whole spiel. If the market drops, then you keep investing at discounted prices. It's not very pleasant, but it may all work out in the end. So in Fritz's defense, I should say that when you're retired, now that sequence of return risk makes you a lot more worried about, say, a drop in the equity market. So having a bit more of a cash cushion while you're in retirement, I'm not that much against that. So there is some rationale for that. But again, I mean, it raises all sorts of other questions too, right? For example, then if there is a drop in the equity market early on while you're retired and you draw money from that cash cushion, then when do you replenish it, right? Do you have time to replenish your cash from your equity holdings before the next recession hits? So in some sense, the cash in early retirement, it obviously hedges against the first bear market. When do you start replenishing? So you almost become like an active asset allocator, right? Where you have money sitting on the sidelines, and then you decide when to draw on that and when to draw on your equity holdings. So in my personal view, it raises more problems than it solves.
Okay, so both of these ideas can coexist in the same universe. That doesn't invalidate the article that you wrote previously highlighting the lack of value of the emergency fund for the FI community, because you're referring, one, to the context of an emergency fund as opposed to a drawdown strategy. And then two, you're talking about the emergency fund, the value of the emergency fund for the FI community specifically. For a community of people that are striving to save more than 50% of their income, they have good cash flow, and potentially they have other options to cash flow emergencies. Is that the basic idea?
Yes, that's the basic idea. But then again, I also think that this emergency fund insanity, as I almost call it sometimes, I think it also hurts people with lower savings rates, right? So imagine you are the average American and you save only 10% of your income every year. Imagine how much time it would take you to get 8 months worth of savings, right? You would be sitting there, you would be plowing cash into a money market account. And it, back then when I wrote that article, the money market account rates were something like 0.5%. Now it's probably 1.5%. But it will take you a lot of time to get to that 8 month savings. It could take you years to get to that 8 month savings. During all that time, you have been missing that opportunity to invest in something more productive, so, such as stocks, right? So, and again, it goes back to that sequence of return risk discussion that we had in episode 35. I like to structure my investments into equities so that I have some cost averaging, right? So you have some, every month you invest in equities, and sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. So sitting out and sitting on your hands for a few years for you to generate that 6 to 8 months cash cushion, you're missing the opportunity of spreading out your equity investments. And of course, sometimes it could work, right? Because you could have invested right before the next bear market and then your equity portfolio goes down. But you could have also missed a great bull run. So you're saving and saving and saving in your money market account, and you're missing out that great bull market from 2009 until 2018. I mean, that would have been a shame. So I think there's actually a universal truth almost to, obviously, to save and to have savings in case you have an emergency. I'm not having a problem with people having a fund to be able to pay for emergencies. I just have a problem of having that much money sitting around in a money market account and earning basically nothing. And it's the great opportunity cost, because equities on average return so much more than your money market account.
So, right. So this is all about opportunity costs. Is why have 3, 6, 9 months of life expenses just sitting in a cash account, essentially doing nothing. I totally get that. And just to bring it back to like a real world perspective, your article definitely opened my eyes. Not that I explicitly have an emergency fund per se, but I probably have more cash lying around than I otherwise would like to. And I just kind of think, oh, I have a little extra buffer in my checking account just in case, quote unquote. But what a really stupid way to look at it. When I read through your article and saying, like, what actually constitutes an emergency that you would need cash on an imminent basis? And they're not many things. I'm thinking about my entire yearly expenses last year. I put most things on a credit card, and that gives me the float until the due date anyway, of which if I didn't have extra cash sitting around, I could find a way to get cash into my checking account by, let's say, selling equities or just a whole host of different options to get that money in to pay my credit card bill. It's not that emergency that needs to happen that very next day. Or let's say we did some work on our house and had our floors redone. But again, that's not an emergency. I could also, again, in that instance, sell equities and get that cash to pay for it. So there are very few instances in my life that are immediately coming to mind that are saying, oh, wow, I need even $3,000 lying around, not less the 3, 6, 9 months worth of yearly expenses that so many of these quote unquote experts are arguing. So, I mean, is that like a fairly good summation on a real world basis?
Right. I mean, that's perfect. That's my article in a nutshell, because again, I also use that credit card float, right? And I wrote in the article that nothing we have in our house that can break that needs to be fixed is really a bill of $1,000 or more, especially so we were living in a condo. I guess if we once we start moving back to a house again, there could be some more expensive repairs like boilers and roof and stuff like that. But especially while living in a condo, there is very little that can break that is a real financial emergency. But even if it happens, right, we had the credit card float. We have a home equity line of credit that we could have used. And so obviously then with a high enough savings rate, put the big expense on the home equity line and then pay that off. So instead of pre-funding everything with cash, I prefer to just keep my money invested productively. And maybe I'm a little bit of a gambler when it comes to the stock market, right? So even if I had something like $20,000 or $25,000 sitting around in a cash account somewhere, along comes this event in early February where the stock market drops by 10%. I mean, at the very latest at that time, I would have deployed that into the stock market because I thought, oh, I mean, stocks are on sale. Let's put more money in it. So even if I had that cash lying around, I probably would have deployed that the next time the stock market drops a little bit. But I mean, I also agree that, I mean, you have to have a little bit of a cushion in your checking account, right? And for us, that's during normal times, it's probably around $1,000 just to make sure that no check bounces, or just to make sure that if I need $200 at the ATM machine, that we'll have the money for that. And now with the move and everything, obviously that cushion has grown a little bit to probably around $5,000 or so. But I don't intend to have much more than just a few thousand dollars in a checking account lying around for any extended time.
So, Ern, you knew when you wrote this that this is going to provoke an emotional response. You're basically taking a lighter and holding it to the foot of the personal finance community. And this is everybody. This is the one sacred cow that they all agree on. This is what brings CFPs, Dave Ramsey, Susan Orman, Scott Allen Turner. You know, this brings everybody together. And you're going to get a response on this. I'm curious, what was that response?
I would put it into three different buckets. Obviously, a lot of people complimented me on the blog post. They said, oh, this is really, I'm glad somebody wrote it because this is what I've been thinking about all along. And you exactly touched that tone that, and you exactly wrote what I'm thinking too. So thanks for writing this. And the second bucket would be, I hear what you're saying, but you know what? I sleep better if I have $20,000 in a money market account, and don't argue with my sleep. And then I responded, yeah, I don't want you to have sleepless nights. It's not worth it. But then the kind of the third bucket was, some people call it the haters or the trolls. I mean, obviously, there were some people who said, well, it's kind of the sob stories of, well, somebody's car broke down and it kind of created a whole chain event of events. So it's basically some people misunderstood what I'm saying. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that you should not have any emergency fund, right? I mean, I prefer if the only two choices are having a $10,000 emergency fund or not having any emergency fund at all, I would still prefer the $10,000 emergency fund. So my argument was more with the, well, where do you keep that money? I would still prefer $10,000 invested in an equity index fund over $10,000 in a money market account and an emergency fund, because over time, obviously, that money grows and you make a lot more money by investing that $10,000 more productively, say, in an equity index fund.
So that makes sense. That doesn't surprise me. Let's kind of slow down and go through some of the obvious sticking points that people would have. And you mentioned one of them, but I think we didn't really go into it with enough depth. Let's say you do have a $10,000 emergency that you cannot. I'm trying to think, and actually I get stuck myself. This is actually why I loved your article so much, but I'm going to try and play devil's advocate here. Let's say you normally you would have this $10,000, $20,000 saved up in an account, but instead you have it in the market and it's 2007, 2008 and the market crashes by 50%. We just talked about earlier how it's not a wide dip, but it was a very deep dip. And your emergency fund goes from $20,000 down to $10,000 right as you need it the most. What's your play there?
I mean, I obviously concede that that is the one case where you would have done worse with the emergency fund, quote unquote, invested in equities. But remember, when did you arrive, or how did you arrive at $20,000 in 2007 at the peak, the person who had an emergency fund invested in cash probably did so during the entire bull market that led to that peak in 2007. So they had they invested $10,000 in the emergency fund in 2003, and that money was going mostly sideways, maybe slightly up. But the person who invested $10,000 in a quote-unquote emergency fund in equities in 2003, that money would have probably doubled by 2007. So even if from 2007 your emergency fund goes down to half, it might still be higher than what somebody else had in the cash or the money market account. So what I'm saying is that, yes, if you can come up with examples where what I'm proposing doesn't work very well, but they have to be really extreme examples where you start out at the most inopportune time and you don't take into consideration that before 2007, that emergency fund invested in equities would have also grown to much more than what the other person would have had in the money market account. And then the other response to that is, so imagine you have $10,000 in cash sitting in a money market account because you're so afraid that if that money had been in equities and a bear market comes along and it drops by 30%, 40%, 50%, which is $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000, well, you also in the background, you potentially have a big equity portfolio of say $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. If you're so worried about a loss of a few thousand dollars in that cash and money market account, shouldn't you be more worried about losing not a few thousand dollars, but a few hundred thousand dollars in your other portfolio? So I think there's a little bit of a disconnect where people have a very nonchalant attitude towards risk in their big investment account, but then they're so almost maniacally risk averse in that the emergency fund space. So, and I always view my and our whole financial situation as one large investment project. So there's not this, so this is why I'm not a big fan of these buckets where I have one bucket that is high risk and another bucket that is moderate risk and another bucket that is low risk. I have one big portfolio and I decide how much risk I want to take there. And if I want to take less risk, yeah, I mean, then I sell some equities and invest in bonds, or I may even hold some cash if I want a lower risk. But I don't quite understand this bucket thinking.
So yeah, I mean, even using that extreme example of the $20,000 emergency fund dropping down to $10,000, it's still real world, right? It comes back to real world, which is the three of us would have to sit here long and hard and think about what is a $10,000 emergency, right? That you can't float on a credit card, that you can't sell other assets. And also, this is presupposing someone who's saving a fairly significant amount of money to get an emergency fund of that size. So they have additional money flowing in every single month. I mean, this is, again, like you're setting up such an interesting example, because I've always taken this as orthodoxy, which is like, okay, you need an emergency fund, right? You need some extra cash lying around. But when you actually sit and think about it, why? Why do you really need that? Why couldn't you access money? I can access money within a couple of days at most. Right? I can sell equities and transfer it over to my bank account and I'm set within 3 calendar days. So I think that to me is the big takeaway. It's, we can argue at the margins about a couple $1,000s here or there. And, you know, some, I understand the psychological aspects, but in real world practical application, like, you don't need this huge pot of money sitting there because, like you're saying, Carson, it's opportunity cost. Even in that example you said, they missed the entire run-up. Right. So from 2003 to 2008, you're arguing that might have doubled, and then cutting it down to half would have still put them about $20,000. So it's always so interesting when you really take a step back and think in that manner.
And I think practically what we should talk about specifically for Earn in his particular scenario, and honestly, it's something that both you and I, Brad, could replicate. He's got that credit card float, which we talked about, 30 days, basically interest free. He's got his paycheck, which, you know, he's saving 50% plus. And in his case, he's got his brokerage accounts where he has over 30x at this point of his annual expenses. And then finally, and this is something that we haven't mentioned, but it's incredibly powerful and it's worthy of additional conversations, he's got a HELOC. And that's a home equity line of credit for someone that's hearing that word for the first time. But this is access to a relatively low interest loan on demand. And when you put all of those together, you realize that a 3 to 6 month emergency fund is just a waste of mental space for him at this point in time. So, I mean, you can definitely see how those tools come together. And what's interesting about highlighting the HELOC is that that is an advantage of homeownership that we really haven't talked about. And I only bring that up to say that last fall, we released an episode 47 with the power couple from Millennial Revolution, Bryce and Christy, called The Cult of Home Ownership. A little bit of a bumper sticker clickbait title there, but basically saying your home is a horrible investment. And it was a fantastic episode, but EARN doesn't just stick it to the personal finance community when the FI community tries to take a very nuanced set of circumstances and slap a bumper sticker on it and then walk away. He digs into the math of that too. And so EARN, I want to, as we kind of wrap this episode up, give you a few minutes to talk about what we just glossed over when highlighting the home being a bad investment.
Oh, yeah. So I generally enjoyed that episode, but I think that doing the math of renting versus owning, there are a lot of things that you can mess up. And if you mess them up, you can get very nonsensical results. So, for example, a little bit of my soul dies every time when I see comparisons of real estate returns versus equity returns. And then what people do is they look at equity returns, say a 10% annualized return over some interval. And then real estate returns, well, they look at home prices, and home prices go up by maybe about the inflation rate, maybe a little bit more than the inflation rate over the last few years. Then you say, well, the equities obviously beat real estate. And of course, that's incorrect, because what you get with real estate is you get essentially a dividend. And of course, it's not a cash dividend because you don't observe any cash flow, but you get a dividend because you get to live somewhere for free, right? If you have a house that's worth $200,000, yes, that house may not appreciate very much and is a total hassle, right? You have to pay property taxes. You have to, if you buy it and sell it, there are transaction costs involved with that. But the one big advantage of having that house is that you get to live in a place. And whereas if you have a $200,000 equity portfolio with Fidelity or Vanguard, then Fidelity and Vanguard does not offer you a room to stay, right? You get only that. You get only your price return plus dividend yield. That is very impressive sometimes. I mean, as I said, the equities have returned something like 6.5 to 7% in real terms over the very long term. So you add to that some inflation. With inflation, it would have been probably around 10%. But the home also gives to you that the fact that you don't have to rent a place. So, and if you were to add back that rental, quote unquote, return that you get from your home, you can get absolutely astronomical returns as a homeowner. And I just did the calculation for my apartment. I bought an apartment in San Francisco in 2008 when I moved here. And we just sold it earlier this year. So we've lived here for almost 10 years. And if you just look at the price return, especially after factoring in some of the fees and taxes and brokerage fees, I think the price return was only about just under 5%. But if you factor in that I got to live in San Francisco for 9.5 years in this condo. So San Francisco is now one of the most expensive places to live in the country. So if I factor in that additional return that I got by not having to pay rent for a similar or identical unit in this building, I also factor in the fact that, there was a little bit of leverage involved, obviously, right? Because I had a mortgage. And I factor in a little bit, not much, but a little bit of a tax advantage because I can write off my mortgage interest. Factoring that all in, I basically beat the equity return over the last 9.5 years very easily. I think I have a return. I did some back of the envelope calculation. I'll probably write a blog post about this in the future, but I think I have a return of about 16 to 17%, which is more than the equity market return since 2008. Remember, I probably would have gotten an even better return if I had bought this unit a little bit later, because there was also a little bit of a dip in property prices in San Francisco. But both the stock market and the real estate market around that time were near their peak. So from 2008 until now, the equity market has not returned as much as I made on this unit. And again, this unit increased by only 4.6 or 4.7% per year. But again, you have to factor in all that additional benefit that you get as a homeowner, because you get to live somewhere for free.
So, you know, Brad, there's nothing better than releasing an episode, going on vacation, and while you're on vacation, seeing a new article from Big Earn come out saying, wow, that was stupid. And then watching him break down all the little details that you missed and being like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, I don't disagree with that. That's cool. That's cool. But I do think that even as I read through your article, I think that there are points that you made that were completely valid and also things that you conveniently glossed over. And I'd love to get you to put both of those side by side. Like, for instance, points that you made that were incredibly valuable. And now I'm going to basically riff off of J.L. Collins' article, Why Your Home is a Terrible Investment. And things that he specifically mentioned were things like, you have all these repairs, the house is slowly crumbling, you have all these taxes, you have all these different things that come with home ownership. And I think you very rightly pointed out that you're still paying for that as a renter, because the person that owns a property that is renting it out has to make profit, and that has to be the maintenance and taxes and all that has to be accounted for in the price of the rental property. I think that in my mind, some of the points that J.L. Collins made that weathered the storm of Big Earn poking the bear was talking about illiquidity and inventory. You very rightly, in your example, you highlighted the example of a house in the Midwest costing $166,000. And you even took the time to point out that you shouldn't get high on housing inventory. You know, that starter home at $600,000, $700,000. And that was, in reality, the example that was highlighted in episode 47 with Millennial Revolution. A starter home for them was $500,000, $600,000. It really does depend on your specific situation. You're tied to that particular location. It may be very hard to sell if you're in a recession, when you go to leave, and you may be tempted to buy more house than you need because, you know, you want to get your forever home as your starter home. All of those things come into play, and it's very hard to tease out in one particular episode. And that's why I think the conversation was important. But do you have any thoughts on those negative benefits, in particular, the illiquidity of being tied to one particular geographic location?
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. Illiquidity is a problem. And don't buy a home if you're not going to stay there for at least 5 years, probably even better, 10 years. So I totally agree with that. And I should also say that, I mean, just to show how non-dogmatic I am about home ownership, we just sold our apartment here. And we are probably not going to buy one anytime soon. So we're probably going to settle down in Nevada in 2019, maybe 2020, and we'll do a lot of traveling before then. And while traveling, we'll actually do the exact same thing as Millennial Revolution, right? So when we are on the road and we are traveling for, say, 3 months in Europe and then another 3 months in Asia, we don't want to have a house here, right? So that's just a cost factor, and we don't get anything out of that. So absolutely, we will not own a home for a while. And then maybe even for the first few months or even years in the new location, we might be renters. But again, eventually we would like to settle down long term, and then we'll probably have a house again for that reason, because I think a house is actually a pretty decent investment.
So, Earn, just going back to the buy versus rent, I am a homeowner, and in my mind, whether this is right or wrong, this is just emotional, is this was a bad decision. But again, it's all about the math. So what I would love is almost like a horse race type scenario where you could set up for me, okay, here's approximately what would have happened if you rented, and here's approximately what would have happened if you bought. So at the end of the day, for me, it's just, what would my net worth have been in February of 2018 if I had bought this house in 2005? And what would it have been had I rented and invested the 20% down payment that I put just into this dopey house and invested in the market then? So for me, it's like, it's all about that, just that one number, like that horse race. Is that something that you have available on your site now?
I don't have that available right now on the site, but what I, so I did that Google sheet, and that's part of that article that you're probably going to reference. And what I did in that Google sheet is it's basically a hypothetical, say 10-year or whatever is your horizon in living in this house. So a 10-year horizon sample calculation where you take into account, I mean, not just the purchase price, but also whether you get a mortgage or not, whether or not or how much of your mortgage interest is tax deductible, whether your property taxes are tax deductible, what kind of home price appreciation do you expect, what kind of maintenance cost do you have to factor in every year. And then you can look at, say you pick a 10-year horizon. Then over the 10-year horizon, you can see what is the cash flow if I had been a renter and what is the cash flow if I had been a homeowner. And then obviously as a homeowner, you would have outflows early on. And then obviously over time, probably you're going to beat the renter. And over time, renting becomes more and more expensive. Then towards the end of the investment horizon, obviously as a homeowner, imagine then you sell the house and you pay the realtor fees. And you can then look at these two cash flows and see, well, what if I had invested the difference between these two cash flows, right? So you could say that would be the investment portfolio and the investment flows of the renter. So depending on what time interval you pick for that, you will potentially beat the equity market, even if the home appreciated by only very little. And the reason is, again, in a lot of places, your rental yield is really high. I mean, we're looking at something like 10% rental yield in a lot of locations. If you talk to some people like Coach Carson, he's a real estate investor, and they actually look for rental yields of 12% per year. So they have that 1% rule, and they look for a return on your investment of 1%, at least at the gross level, in terms of just the rental income. Given that huge dividend, quote unquote, that you get as a homeowner every month, it could be potentially relatively easy to beat the equity market over that horizon. But then again, I mean, you have to look at the two cash flow series, and you could actually even customize that for your personal situation. Look at the equity returns, or again, question is, would you have invested that all in equities, or is that more of an equity bond portfolio? Is that more of a 60-40 portfolio? It's not certain that you would have invested all of that money all in equity. So
can I volunteer Brad for a future EARN case study, assuming that he's 100% VTSAX?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm in. I think that's great. And yeah, I mean, so we talked about opportunity costs with the emergency fund so significantly. And I hear you about it's hard to know, would I have invested that down payment that day into the stock market? But if we assume that I did, right, that to me, that opportunity cost of that money just sitting there, essentially doing nothing, as opposed to it could have been in the stock market growing significantly over a 13-year period, that has to be factored into it. It just can't be on the future, the additional payments and the delta between your rent and your mortgage plus all the expenses, et cetera, right? Like the full opportunity cost has to factor in what that idle cash is doing, just sitting in equity.
That's right. That's exactly the calculation. But one other point I still wanted to sneak in here is that obviously sometimes home ownership can be bad for you financially, because as we said earlier, people buy too big a house, but that may not be the problem of the rent versus buy decision, right? That's the decision of how much house you want to rent or buy. So we have to disentangle these two decisions and not confound them. One is decide how much housing do you want and need? And two, do you want to buy or rent that level of housing? And again, so my analysis on my blog post and that Google sheet that I created, that is about the rent versus buy decision. It doesn't educate you about, should I buy a 2,000 square foot house or should I buy a 5,000 square foot McMansion somewhere?
Cool. Well, I am looking forward to that case study. I'm all about that. Maybe we can make that happen for the Friday roundup, in fact.
Sounds good.
All right. Perfect, guys. Well, EARN, I love that you're an equal opportunity poke the bear type guy and that you're just as willing to friendly fire, the FI community, which is just perfect. And thank you so much for being willing to come on the show and walk through these incredible value-added conversations.
Yeah, thank you too. It was a lot of fun, and I'll see you at Camp FI in April.
Can't wait, buddy. That's going to be a lot of fun, and it's coming up fast. Congratulations on pulling the trigger on FI. We are so excited for you. Brad, these are the types of episodes that you have to have. You know, I think one of the things that really stood out to me about this last article that we were talking about from Big Earn is that he said it's so easy just to write a bumper sticker and mic drop and walk off. But life is more complicated than that. It's more nuanced. And the problem is most of us get scared of the nuances and we try to walk away from it. Carsten walks into the nuances. I mean, he is willing to just dive in and get as close to objective, quantifiable truth as possible. That is why I love bringing him back on the show. And I love that he even says that him coming on the show back in episode 35, for him, inspired him to really dig into all this new content.
Yeah, and life is about nuance. Things are never black and white. So it's kind of hard, even for us, Jonathan, even though we have so many hours of audio, sometimes we're relegated to bumper stickers, and maybe that's our own fault, our own limitations, but it's hard when you're speaking to a diverse audience sometimes to touch on every little nuance and touch on every little situation. So invariably, we'll get people saying, oh, but X, Y, and Z, right? And my response is, yeah, of course, that makes sense. I get it. And I love hearing these different opinions, these different thoughts, and to challenge the orthodoxy. You might hear things, and like Jonathan, you kind of alluded to in the episode, while the FI community is contrarian off the traditional Susie Orman type personal finance world, you still can't get locked into a way of thinking. So Earn challenges that. People like Earn challenge that. And that is only beneficial and helpful for the entire community. And yeah, I just wanted to quickly say a big thanks to Carsten for coming on and revealing his identity, telling us about this amazing new life chapter, and a huge congratulations to their entire family.
All right, guys, I hope you got value from this episode, and I hope you've been getting value from all the episodes up to this point. If you haven't done this yet, just take a second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know that you want to be here when we produce additional content. And if you want to support us in what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are four easy ways. One, leave us an iTunes review. If you want to do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. Two, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. Three, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free. And just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And four, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 38, The Why of FI. And right behind that, have them go listen to episode 21, The Pillars of FI. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.